Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, straddle the line in discord and rhyme. We're on the hunt. We're after you. This is The Hunt. Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Blast Zone.
Welcome to The Blast Zone.
We are not a podcast about bad movies. We are a podcast about movies that did badly.
That's right.
I am John Drake, in-house film critic of my Letterboxd account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like The Hunt, which we'll be talking about today. But before we get into that, Ian, how are you doing?
Well, I wanted to give an update on the jury duty plot line that I introduced a couple episodes ago in our Napoleon episode. And the update is I'm free. I'm a free man.
Woo.
I had to go down one more day to the courthouse and then I was let go, but it was close, man. It was tense. The judge basically had already rejected my excuse when I told him I have an upcoming vacation with plane tickets and things that's not refundable. So as I sat there sweating, I thought my goose was totally cooked, that I was either going to have to bail on my vacation or go on the lam and accept the court's punishment. But apparently the plaintiff's lawyers didn't like the thoughts I shared with them, where I said things like, I'm opposed to retributive justice and I think the whole system is antiquated and wrong, and that got them thinking that maybe I would not award their client a multi-million-dollar settlement. So I was their first peremptory strike, and I hope I didn't offend them. They all seemed like nice people, but I had the biggest smile on my face when I stood up and left the jury box. Like, I couldn't help grinning my way out of the courtroom so fast.
We should say that the case you were up for was a movie studio trying to recoup losses from a movie that bombed. So
yes,
you were in a unique position to be let go from serving on the jury.
The plaintiff was David Zasloff, and I had absolutely no sympathy for him.
Oh, yeah. If he was the defendant, I would have definitely lobbied to be in the jury just so I would be the guy who reads the verdict. I would lobby hard to be able to read guilty.
Wearing a Punisher t-shirt.
Exactly. But yeah, that's great news. We're glad you get to go on your vacation. You've been looking forward to that for a while. I'm very happy for you.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Pretty good. It's been a quiet week. Everyone's relatively healthy. I know I'm going to jinx it now.
I was going to ask. Your voice sounds better. You seem like you're not sick for once. But then again, January's over. Maybe that was the month of sick and you're turning a new page.
Yeah. Hey, look, January felt like a long month, maybe because I was sick for three quarters of it. It's February now. It's a great month, short month.
That's right.
The month of my wedding anniversary
Cool. Coming
up. So that'll be fun. We're 8 years in.
Nice. Congrats.
Thanks. We will be taking a trip in March for that. We're going to go to Portland.
Oh, cool.
Oregon. Never been. So it's really exciting. Some of the characters in this movie would tell you Portland's a war zone and you shouldn't go there.
That's right. They're scared to get out of their lifted trucks.
Oh, brother. We're getting ahead of ourselves, Ian. You got to tell the listeners what you watched this week.
I have given the listeners a twofer today, a Betty Gilpin twofer. Ooh. By combining The Hunt with Mrs. Davis, which is an 8-episode limited series. It came out on Peacock last year in April of 2023. The show is co-created by a writer named Tara Hernandez, whose main credits are Big Bang Theory and Young Sheldon.
Interesting.
But she teamed up with Damon Lindelof, so it's actually a Lindelof twofer as well. It's a cool show. Stylistically, it's this kind of intense but somewhat surreal and silly sci-fi comedy. The style reminds me a lot of the works of Jason Pargin, who I'm a fan of.
Oomphs.
Yeah. As in today's movie, Betty Gilpin plays a lovable badass in Mrs. Davis. And just like in today's movie, she totally carries the show on her back. She's incredible. At first, the show is a little off-putting. It does start with three different setup sequences. It takes a while before you connect the dots on what's going on in this
John Carter-esque show.
It's a big concept, heavy premise sci-fi thing. But once Betty gets on screen, the action starts to ramp up. I got pretty into it. If you're a fan of hers or you're a fan of weird, funny sci-fi, I'm going to recommend it.
Nice. I'm very much a big fan of Betty Gilpin.
Yeah.
And Damon Lindelof. That's my motherfucking boy. Everything he works on seems to resonate with me. So I don't know how this show came and went without me noticing. It seems to be happening a lot lately.
It's super weird. It's a Peacock production. So I think it was something they took a shot on, but it was never really destined for multiple seasons. So they didn't have a reason to keep putting air under it, you know, pushing it.
Yeah. Just talking to you off air about, it's not my show and tell this week, but a Nick Hughes and Craig Zobel show called $1 that apparently came out in in 2018 and I have no recollection of this at all. And I can't watch it anywhere. So there's just so much stuff coming
out. Sounds like a similar case. Yeah.
So much stuff coming out. It's easy to lose yourself in the sea of content. I also watched a show for my show and tell this week.
Okay.
Appropriately. It is a new limited series from Netflix, from the team that did Narcos and Narcos Mexico, which if you listen to the show, you know are some of my faves.
Yeah, that's your jam.
That's my shit. And it's the Griselda Show with Sofia Vergara. I think there was a lot of criticism about Narcos, the Colombian seasons, the first three, for not really mentioning Griselda Blanco or dealing with her at all. And apparently Sofia Vergara has been trying to get this made for a decade now with her star power from Modern Family. She was a known actress before that, but not necessarily a huge name. And she's been trying to get this made for quite some time. She finally did it. She's extremely too attractive to play Griselda Blanco convincingly.
Okay.
But you know, them's the breaks. And
it's Hollywood.
It's got a different vibe from Narcos and Narcos Mexico because it takes place in Miami in the 80s. There's a lot of lavish mansions and yachts and parties and nightclubs. And I think it's a little toned down in the kind of grimness and the violence. I do think Netflix, contrary to like what Peacock did with Mrs. Davis, I do think Netflix is really trying to push this as a big wintertime limited series to get as many eyeballs on it as possible. So they maybe soften the edges a little bit. There's still machete attacks, but like fewer.
Okay.
But overall, it was good. I think Sofia Vergara did a great job playing a character that's worlds different from what we've seen before. She really descends rapidly into paranoia and madness, and it's pretty scary to see. And Alberto Guerra, who plays her third husband, Dario, and her husband for most of the show, is another bright spot. He was great as El Mayo in season three of Narcos Mexico, the co-head of the Sinaloa cartel, who's still at large. Actually, he's never been caught. He's Chapo's counterpart. They're a team.
All right, don't say anything bad. He might be listening.
I like the actor that played him. I couldn't pick him out of a lineup.
Okay.
And I never would, even if I could.
Of course not.
I don't know nothing, coppers. I'm not planning to go to Sinaloa anytime soon. I was just in Puerto Vallarta a few months ago, though, so yeah, okay. Be careful.
Sure.
But yeah, if you like crime dramas, the Narcos shows especially, it's very much in that vein, and I do recommend it. I had fun with it. It was just too short. Six episodes? Like, what's with these six-episode shows now? I want more. True Detective, six episodes also, and we're already halfway done? You gotta be shitting me.
I don't know, though. I kind of like that. I've been hesitating. I know I gotta start True Detective, and I'm like, oh, when you tell me it's six, I'm like, oh, I think I can handle it. I might be able to do it.
It's the further Britishification of American television, the short standalone seasons. It does make for, I think, better storytelling. I think the problem I have with short seasons is I remember stuff like season five of The Wire was supposed to be 10 episodes and it got shortened to 8 and then it just didn't feel right. But when you plan it to be that length from the very beginning, I think it's fine.
Yeah, short TV can be good. Shortened TV can be disappointing.
Exactly. Well said, as always, Ian. So let's talk about The Hunt. What do you remember about this movie? It came out relatively recently and it was big news, but maybe not for the content of the actual movie. Do you remember that controversy?
I do. I didn't pay close attention. So I remember hearing the name and the controversy on both sides and not knowing too much about it at the time. I presumed that it was a dumber movie made by shallower people who were just trying to capitalize cheaply on the controversy of the moment, which is fair to assume. But then as we'll get into, the movie's smarter and more interesting than I thought it would be. But I'm not sure if we'll totally be able to absolve it of the accusation of like, they made it because it's provocative.
Right.
And so maybe it's not like cheaply provocative, but in a sense, I think they thought it was like too tempting not to shed Hollywood movie blood over this topic that has a lot of people shedding tears online.
I think seeing the initial like teaser trailer or hearing the synopsis, it's like, okay, another kind of battle royale, Hunger Games type movie with a political bent. I probably wouldn't have given it a second thought, but then you start looking at the talent involved in it. Damon Lindelof, King of the Nerds, just a genre legend, written stuff like Watchmen and Lost and all this stuff that stood the test of time. And also stuff like Prometheus, which some people like, I do,
yes,
but not everyone. And then Craig Zobel, who his movie work has been maybe inconsistent or just there's not a lot of it, but he directed some of the best episodes of television ever made. Like some of those really pivotal Leftovers episodes that are just like mind-blowingly good.
Okay.
That was him. And all of Mare of Easttown. Of course, this movie came out before Mare of Easttown, so we didn't know that yet.
We didn't know.
But that was the first indication that maybe there's a little more at play here than first glance would have you believe.
And Watchmen, the show, had come out and I had loved it. And I think I must not have known that Lindelof was associated with this movie because I made none of that connection when I was poo-pooing what I thought it might be. Because if I had gone, oh, it's a Lindelof thing, there's got to be something more to it. And there is. There's at least a really exciting, fast-paced action horror comedy. We'll debate exactly what genre this movie's in, but it's pretty cool.
If you just take it on surface level as a montage of cool kills, then it works damn well. But I don't think that's what the filmmakers were going for. I think they had some grander aspirations.
They kind of do. It's fun to talk about. I was worried that talking about the politics of this movie would be sticky and awful, but they're kind of light. That's one of the criticisms people who might actually get around to watching it go, oh, wait a minute, this movie is a little more both sidesy than I thought, and it's not very deep.
It's kind of toothless.
Yeah, exactly. It takes shots at both sides. It doesn't have a big moralistic ending. It has kind of a deflating ending.
It feels like a South Park type of social commentary, which is just like, isn't everyone crazy?
It's a little bit. Thankfully, they didn't go with the heavy-handed South Park model and like scold everybody on both sides for being dumb idiots.
Maybe sometimes South Park would do that with things that were completely legitimate, like climate change. They'd be like, you buffoons believing in climate change. And then like 10 years later, or 15 years later, they had to make a new episode with Man Bear Pig to be like, oh, he is real. Because that was their metaphor for climate change.
I didn't even get that, all that stuff.
Man Bear Pig is real. I'm super serial.
We're super serial about this movie. It's super fun. And it's fun to speculate about. So it's not going to be a bummer.
No.
Don't tune out right now because you think we're going to get mired in some gross blue versus red politics. We'll have to talk about it, but I think we'll talk about a lot of fun things we liked about the movie.
Yeah. Do you want me to get into the making of the movie?
I'm very curious to hear how this thing happened.
All right. The Hunt didn't start its life with the intention of being a firebrand for controversy. Or maybe it did, who the fuck knows. Originally announced in March 2018, the movie was written by Nick Cuse and Damon Lindelof, giving it a solid pedigree among genre fans before one frame was shot. Intended to be a satire of the extreme political divide in the United States that displays members of the quote-unquote liberal elite hunting conservatives for sport, rumors persisted that the movie was operating under the working title Red States vs. Blue States, though Universal Pictures denies this was ever the title. The film, now called The Hunt, found its director with Craig Zobel, who had directed relatively unknown movies like Compliance and Z for Zachariah, but was a force in the prestige TV world. With a modest $14 million budget, Zobel cast dependable and well-liked actors who fell just short of the A-list, bringing on names like Betty Gilpin, Glenn Howerton, Ike Barinholtz, Amy Madigan, and Hilary Swank.
Yeah, those actors, you don't have to pay $1 million, baby.
Filming took place in New Orleans from February 20th, 2019 to April 5th of the same year, and release was scheduled for September 27th, 2019. On August 6th of 2019, Universal held a test screening in Los Angeles, which rumors stated did not go well at all, with audience members expressing discomfort with the politics of the film. Universal pushed back against a variety of reports stating the same, but nonetheless delayed the film indefinitely on August 7th. The company line was this was done to be more sensitive in the wake of the Dayton and El Paso mass shootings, but by August 9th, the movie was front page material, as Donald Trump had made a statement that, quote, the movie coming out is made in order to inflame and cause chaos, without actually naming The Hunt, but most were able to read between the lines.
Except for Trump himself, who's unable to read.
Other media personalities argued the movie had a right-wing bent and was anti-liberal. In February 2020, Universal added the film back to its release schedule following the success of the similarly controversial film Joker, and released a new trailer announcing the movie would be released on Friday the 13th, March 13th, 2020.
Call me superstitious, but I got a bad feeling about the second week of March 2020.
The film's marketing leaned into the controversy now, with the new poster featuring quotes from enraged viewers and featuring the tagline, "The most talked about movie of the year is one that no one's actually seen," which is also just bad copywriting. The movie didn't have a great opening, making just $5.3 million its opening weekend and getting mixed reviews, but the gambit from Universal may have ultimately worked if it wasn't for a little thing called COVID-19. Theaters closed nationwide, some never to reopen, extremely early in the film's run, and The Hunt was quickly put on streaming. The movie has gained momentum, though, as a cult classic, a misunderstood gem with a great central performance and tons of cool kills.
Cool kills.
Cool kills left and right. Cool kills.
Quite impressive budget. It didn't sink into me what the actual budget of the movie was until you just read it out for us there.
Impressive in the sense that they did a lot with a little, you mean?
They did a lot, yeah. The setting is very modest. Everything's very grounded and small in scale. So like you get why it didn't cost them a lot, but they got a lot of cool people. Like you mentioned some of them and we'll talk through what roles they play in the movie. It's very much a horror movie style budgeting, right? Let's make a really good movie that just totally works and not spend a lot of money on it.
Well, it was a Blumhouse production. Jason Blum was the producer of the movie, and he's known to stretch a dollar as far as it'll go. He's made an industry out of that, just pumping out these kind of $10 to $20 million movies that exceed their budget many times over at the box office.
It really is ironic that you pointed out how based on that and everything else and generating the controversy was part of the goal of the movie finding its audience, and then just got bit. Perfect timing, a perfectly terrible timing with the shutdown where it got pulled. Did it get pulled on its second week? Or like
it didn't make it to its second weekend.
Oh.
If you look at the box office numbers from the weekend of March 20th, there's like three movies and they're all documentaries. Like okay. It was just, but yeah, I remember they put it on streaming with the $20 price tag like they were doing for streaming on demand. If you wanted to rent it, it was $20, I think, because it was still in theaters, which they did with some other movies that went to streaming earlier than they would have otherwise, if not for the pandemic.
Yeah.
I don't know. They never released any figures as far as I could tell to know if the movie was a hit on streaming. We just know it wasn't a hit theatrically.
But that budget's small enough that they could have actually made a lot of the cash back with those VOD rentals and stuff. And just in, no one knows how they make money on streaming movies. I guess, you know, they divvy up the monthly membership fees and spread them out over a million properties.
Well, this wasn't a membership situation. This was like you had to rent it. But I think what you're describing was one of the big crux of the recent strikes in the industry was like, we don't get residuals anymore because stuff goes to streaming and then right. We never hear about how it's performing.
It's a black box. No one knows where the money is circulating inside those systems.
And some might argue that there is no money circulating because it's a flawed system that nobody ever really thought to check if it would scale.
Yeah, that whole part of the industry may be a hidden.com bubble kind of scenario where they're like, let's get eyeballs and we'll figure out what the revenue model is later, which is probably why we see every month another announcement that your streaming site is raising its monthly price once again.
Or it's adding ads inside its shows.
Both at the same time, yeah.
Which I think is even more of a problem for filmmakers and showrunners. Like you told me I was making a show that wouldn't have commercials, that would be viewed in this kind of theater-like atmosphere where there's no distractions, and now you're going to cut to a toilet paper commercial every 22 minutes in my drama.
Yeah, I think there were some ads on this. I watched it on Peacock, and I pay for Peacock, and I still get ads.
But speaking of like stretching the budget, there's a lot of cool practical effects in this movie, which I was really happy about. There's a good amount of gore. It's a bloody movie, but lots of good, solid squibs and little rubber spikes sticking out of people. They went for it. It feels old school in that sense.
Yeah, it's simple. It's an unassuming film, like the ordinary blue collar people who are being hunted.
Oh, brother. All right, let's get talking about this plot so we can expand on some of this.
All right, I'm going to dive into it. In a group text chat, a friend group of wealthy business executives joke about something called the hunt, which involves, quote, going out to the manor and slaughtering a dozen deplorables. Ha ha, or were they really joking? Cut ahead to a group of wealthy execs on a nighttime flight aboard a large private jet. Their trip is disrupted when Randy, a disoriented man in denim and flannel, staggers into the cabin. One rich passenger tells the groggy man, "You woke up too soon." And then he proceeds to stab Randy in the neck with a pen. Randy continues to fight back until the trip's leader, a woman named Athena, steps in and finishes him off by putting her stiletto heel right through his eye. Next thing we see, it's morning, and a blonde woman awakes to find herself in a forest clearing with a bunch of other strangers who've also been drugged and left there. The abductees see a crate, and they open it to find that it's full of weapons, plus a small pig wearing a beret. But as they start distributing the guns amongst themselves, the blonde woman is killed by a sniper shot to the head. Somebody's shooting at them from a nearby bunker, so they scatter. But as they try to flee, several others are killed by landmines and booby traps. Three of them escape the forest to a highway and find Ma and Pop's gas station market. By now, the victims have recognized each other as conservative cultural archetypes from around the country. And they're wary because they realize they're being hunted, just like they'd heard about in the conspiracy theory called Manorgate. Unfortunately, they're not quite wary enough, as the older couple behind the counter murders all three of them with poison gas and poison donuts. Then Ma and Pop hurry to reset their shop as they hear over the radio that another one of their prey is on her way up the road.
All right, so we got to start with our first fundamental disagreement here. You think this is a horror movie.
Yeah.
I feel like it's much more of an action movie.
I'll tell you why I think it's a horror movie, although I'm not going to like totally disagree with you. It's also an action movie. It has kind of a Die Hard-y kind of feeling to it, too. There's a tough hero thrown into a tough situation and has to fight back against a group of people with guns. But here's why I think it's horror-y.
You make it sound like it's immodest. It's horror-y.
It's horror-y. It's kind of horror-y. It's been horroring around town. First of all, just the mechanics of it. It's people fleeing from faceless, senseless killers. The first kills we see involve a guy being stabbed in the neck with a pen and squirting blood all over, then having his eye skewered with a stiletto heel, and she pulls the eyeball off the heel of her shoe. You wouldn't see that in a pure action movie, like, or maybe you would. Back in the day, they used to do some grisly things.
If you've seen like the more recent Rambo movies, they are gorier than any horror movie that's ever been made.
That last Rambo was kind of horror action too.
Actually, the one two Rambos ago, which I think was just called.
Was that two ago?
When he's in the jungle in Burma, I think.
Full Gonzo bloodlust movie.
Yeah, but then he made like a home invasion cartel one too.
Oh.
That was equally as bloody.
I missed that one. But yeah, so there's definitely some horror style violence. There's horror style killings. There's the conceptual part that these are victims who are being punished somehow for moral transgressions, although that holds up kind of nowhere in the horror genre, whether it's teenagers who are being sexually promiscuous or conservatives who are being conservatively promiscuous.
Would you like to play a game?
And then it starts out by trying to put a scream queen in the heroine seat, Emma Roberts, who I don't really know, but was the star of one of the Screams and a horror comedy series called Scream Queens. When you put her face on screen and she just looks like this archetype in the movie, this blonde sorority girl in a puffy vest, you're kind of suggesting that genre, especially like with, oh, I don't know what you call those gags. They all had those gross gags.
Yeah, it's like a BDSM thing.
Yeah, rubber gags in their mouths when they woke up. So definitely there was some things that evoked horror for me, but it's multiple genres. It's certainly a hybrid of comedy and multiple genres.
Emma Roberts was in one of the most frightening movies I've ever seen. It's called Little Italy. It stars her and Hayden Christensen. It's a romantic comedy.
Oh.
It's fucking horrible. No, but I take all your arguments there and I reject each one of them in kind.
Okay.
The reason being, it's my personal opinion, can't be a horror movie if it's never trying to scare you. And I don't think this movie ever is interested in scaring anybody.
Uh-huh.
Even the scenes on the plane, there's very little tension there. There's no suspense. And the movie's goal is to titillate with extreme violence, much like the John Wick films or those old John Woo movies. The violence is the spectacle, and that's what's the hook. So I compare it more to those. I don't think there's any violence in this movie we wouldn't see in a John Wick movie.
Yeah, there's some impaling, a little bit of stabbing, and a lot of just shooting with guns and some blowing up with grenades. Pretty standard action fare. I'll take that point.
Yeah. And also, once you're outside that initial setup and you know what's happening, now the movie's really an action comedy because it's funny.
Yeah.
You know, which is great. It made it more enjoyable to watch. But I think if it was trying to be a horror movie, you keep deflating the tension by inserting these really funny lines and situations.
You're right. There's only a little bit of stalking, and it is restricted to that first scene in the clearing where you actually have something that you can't see chasing you and killing you, which to me feels horror-y. But then, yeah, you're right. After that, it's more like combat than it is like something lurking, and there's no jump scares. There's none of those aspects of a horror movie.
Let's talk about our deplorables. You mentioned Emma Roberts already. She's pretty fun in this very limited role. I love a protagonist fake out, and this movie has a few of them.
Yeah, that's a bold move. I think you don't get that unless you have a writer as bold and risk-taking as Damon Lindelof.
It's one of his hallmarks, actually, I would say. It's almost a signature of his now.
Oh, really? To kill off protagonists and pull the rug on you?
He famously wanted to kill Jack in the pilot of Lost.
Oh, really?
It was supposed to be Michael Keaton, and they would just kill him off at the end of the first episode, but then they cast Matthew Fox instead, and they liked him so much, they were like, oh, gotta keep him.
Interesting. So he's getting back. He kills three protagonists in this movie, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, Emma Roberts, the distractingly handsome Justin Hartley, and Ike Barinholtz, who's playing against type a little bit in this movie. He's not like a goofball.
No, he's fun.
He's fun, but he's also kind of capable, right? He seems not quite on Crystal's level, but he knows what he's doing. He knows his way around a gun. He gets people over the fence. He keeps his head relatively cool when they're being shot at with arrows. I was like, okay, this guy is okay.
Yeah, he's almost savvy enough to catch Ma and Pop in their fake act, or at least he holds a gun on them the whole time because he doesn't trust them. So he's smart. He's not a dumb victim. He's not a goofball. They get the drop on him.
And he's from Shaolin, Staten Island, New York. So
yeah,
that's got to be worth something.
And he owns 7 guns.
It's his constitutional right. So Hartley's whole sequence when he seems like the protagonist is great.
Yes.
This girl falls into a pit. He just yanks her off these spikes, one through like her upper leg and one through her abdomen. And she's mysteriously okay.
Running away after he pulls her off.
They step on a landmine and she gets blown back into the pit. And
now well, she's half of her does.
A torso on a spike.
Yeah, her legs. You see her legs go flying, which I got to say was a cool kill.
Cool kill. Cool kill.
I mean, her whole sequence was a 3-part cool kill. She's impaled. She's blown up and she's impaled again. And then that's when Staten Island finds her, right? And she calls him a snowflake and says, give me your gun, and kills herself.
She just wants someone to shoot her and put her out of her misery, but he won't do it. And I see her point. I don't think she was going to make it out of there. Okay.
No, she was right.
She had seconds, if anything, left of what I can only imagine is excruciating pain. And then the three that get it at the gas station, one of them is your boy.
My guy.
Sturgill Simpson.
Academy Awards nominee, Sturgill Simpson.
Academy Award watcher, Sturgill Simpson. He's been known to watch the Oscars from time to time.
And you will note that when we chatted about this, I tried to say something positive about him, which was his acting certainly got better between this and The Creator, where I had qualms about his acting.
Ian's got qualms. That should be a new set. We should have a sound bite for that.
Yeah. Just
qualms.
Yeah, we might need a little bite.
Qualms.
Yeah, Sturgill doesn't, he has 2 or 3 little short lines, and he plays a dopey Vanilla Ice-esque guy from Florida with tattoos and funny hair.
Literally credited as Vanilla Nice.
Oh, okay.
That's his character's name.
And he barely pulls those lines off. It doesn't matter because it's a dumb role and it's jokey anyway. But I'm like, this guy's struggling to be in movies, but he's getting better. What can I say?
He says to Barinholtz, I think the only line I remember from him was like, what's the plan, khaki man? And then he goes, oh, sorry. Like,
yeah,
he scolds himself for saying it immediately, like before anyone else does. And I was like, what a weird little character this
weird is. Character? Was that an ad lib? Like, you do feel like the actor is experiencing those emotions.
Yeah.
But maybe he's just that good. I don't want to spend a long time harping on Sturgill Simpson. I hope the best for him.
Who gets all of 3 minutes of screen time. All right. So there is a running theme, though, throughout this movie, which is kind of an Animal Farm motif. There's a pig running around named Orwell. Athena refers to Crystal as Snowball. You were wondering if there was any point to all this or if it was just a literary device.
The characters themselves call out that this doesn't make any sense. Why is there a pig with a beret? What does this mean? And they don't necessarily come to a conclusion. And me not being very expert on Animal Farm, I wasn't able to solve whether there was really anything there.
I think there might be. And here's my theory on that, is that George Orwell was a bigot. If you research his views
on
things like homosexuality and race, he was not the most progressive fellow, yet these left-leaning villains here that are arranging this hunt have taken him as their mascot, which shows that they're maybe being more performative liberals and are hypocritical. And this is driven home in the third act when Crystal and Athena, spoiler alert, have a conversation about why'd you call me Snowball? And Athena kind of condescendingly explains the plot of Animal Farm to her.
Right.
And Crystal goes, no, I know that. I've read the book, but that's not me. You should be Snowball.
Right.
So I think they're really trying to show that these liberals, these dirty liberals, these are like, they're just full of shit.
I will agree with you on that. I think the biggest point that the whole Orwell thread makes is when you pop its bubble and they deflate it in the end. It's actually, that didn't mean anything except that the liberals thought they were smarter than they were. They tried to create a metaphor that didn't really work, or they got it backwards in a big way.
That might sound like liberal bashing, but like characters on both sides of this movie are so exaggerated that it doesn't really feel like they're taking aim at any real people.
Yeah.
Which is how the movie avoids picking a side and maybe makes it a little toothless, but also makes it easier to digest.
Yeah, and the movie's moving very fast. It's got a breathless kind of pace, which is great. Great for an action thriller. You never get bored. Things are always changing. And it's not until they get to Ma and Pop's gas station that characters actually have a conversation, and some of that liberal versus conservative tropey stuff comes out, and both sides get little pot shots taken at them in equal measure, pretty much.
Yeah, I think the movie does try to do like a one for one. We're not going to be too harsh on one side,
right,
and let the other off the hook. Very fine people on both sides. All right, was there anything from the first section we missed, or should I move on to the middle?
Yeah, why don't you tell us what happens next?
All right. When we first saw the abductee named Crystal, played by Betty Gilpin, aka Bay, she was making a compass out of a leaf and a safety pin. She apparently used her skills and her survival sense to avoid the massacre in the clearing. And now in the gas station, she sniffs out Ma and Pop's deception and kills them before they can kill her. Once back outside, she pulls the fake Arkansas license plate off a booby-trapped pickup truck to reveal a Croatian plate underneath. Then she teams up with another so-called deplorable named Gary. Crystal and Gary hop onto a moving train and discover there's a family of Arabic-speaking refugees sharing the boxcar with them. Gary accuses the refugees of being crisis actors, and when the train is stopped by the Croatian army, one refugee reveals that yes, he was acting. He's really one of the hunters, but he tells Gary and Crystal that the army is real and this wasn't supposed to happen. Gary kills the hunter with a grenade and flees, but Crystal is taken by the army to a refugee camp where she meets another deplorable named Don. Shortly after, a U.S. diplomatic envoy named Oliver arrives and retrieves Crystal and Don from the camp. But as they drive back down a country road, Crystal kicks Oliver out the driver's side door and backs the car over his head, crushing his skull. Don is freaking out, but when they open the trunk, they find Gary's murdered body and a map of the hunter's positions. Crystal was dead right to suspect Oliver, and she's still hungry for revenge on the rest of her tormentors. To illustrate her state of mind, she tells Don a story that her mother used to tell her, the jackrabbit and the box turtle. It's just like the tortoise and the hare, except that after losing, the jackrabbit goes to the box turtle's house, murders the turtle's entire family with a hammer, and eats his dinner. So I think I might have missed a key part here, which is that, is Oliver actually a U.S. diplomatic envoy? Because in the third act, when they're going back to the planning of the hunt, he says, I got reassigned to Croatia.
Oh.
You all have it easy. Because I was like, why did they just hand him over to this guy? Like, if he's a fake diplomatic envoy, he wouldn't have, you know.
I explain that by the fact that they do show that he has a Tupperware full of money that's labeled bribe money. So I just figured that like he came in with the car and the money and the Army general didn't ask questions.
Yeah, they didn't seem overly committed to their jobs.
That guy was committed to eating pickled beets or something. What was he eating? He's eating something out of a jar with his fingers.
Is that like the donuts of Croatia? Pickled beets? Instead of the cops there eat pickled beets instead of donuts?
It seems reductive, but they were interested in painting some broad caricatures of Croatians as well.
They were. Croatians are lazy and not interested in doing their job, according to Nick Hughes and Damon Lindelof.
Allegedly.
Uh-oh.
Not according to me. I love Croatia.
Yeah.
And Croatian people. All right, let's talk about the gas station standoff part two featuring Crystal.
Guess what? The real protagonist just showed up, and it's maybe the second act of the movie. At least that's the way we diagrammed it. That's a bold move, but she's great when she comes in. Like, you love her right away.
She's got a 20 in her sock that they somehow didn't find. She just wants a pack of smokes, but they overcharge her. And for our listeners who maybe aren't in the U.S., the price of cigarettes is mandated by the state. They cost what they cost in each state. She pays with a 20 for a pack of cigarettes and gets a 10 back, which is when she decides to jump the counter, take them both out while yelling at Ma, cigarettes in Arkansas only cost $6. You done fucked up, bitch.
That's a cool kill. It's not too visual. There's a splatter of blood on the window, but it's an emotional kill moment. So that was a good one.
Cool kills.
Yeah, some catharsis there for Crystal, maybe. Yeah. But we're also learning now, like, huh, we saw her doing the little thing in the river in the first act. So we were like, something's up with this lady. And now we're like, she's no civilian. She's very capable.
If this was a horror movie, she's not your average final girl. She's much more of a John McClane unlikely hero who has to step up and show that they're actually really brave and capable.
She's somewhere in between McClane and John Wick, because McClane always seemed a little overmatched, but he somehow came out on top.
Right.
Whereas she is, to put it in Walter White's words, she is the danger.
You're right. She's not quite Wick where she has that pedigree, but somehow she has all the skills and competence that she needs to overmatch everybody in the movie.
And her box turtle monologue, just fantastic stuff.
So good. So let me admit something. I wasn't really aware of Betty Gilpin until I got into this movie, which is why I ended up watching Mrs. Davis, because I'm like, I got to get more Betty immediately after I saw this. She is fantastic. She's almost too good for this movie, but she definitely elevates the movie to a level that it would not get to without her in that starring role. She has a few monologues and scenes where she gets to go off, and the box turtle story is absolutely one of them. It'll floor you. Like, you can't take your eyes off her. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think I first noticed her on Nurse Jackie way back in the early 10s, but when I really became like a stan was Glow. So I would say if you want more Betty, you got to go back and watch Glow on Netflix.
I might have to.
It's a great show overall. A lot of fun. Even if you don't like wrestling, I think you'll get something out of it.
Okay.
Alison Brie, Mark Maron. There's a lot of good performances in there, but Betty Gilpin is the star. She runs away with the show.
See, I didn't know that. She is a star.
It's kind of a two-hander between her and Alison Brie. Like, they're the co-leads, but like, okay. Gilpin's just a powerhouse in that show.
Seeing this, it made me wonder. Obviously, that's a quite credible and successful run of things that she's been in. So it's not like she's undiscovered, but when I saw her in this movie, I'm like, why is she not the star of 5 to 10 other big movies that I should have known about? Like, she's really got some power on the screen.
She's had bad luck in movies. We'll talk about it a little.
Okay.
Also wanted to mention, when she does finally get the cigarettes, the box is empty. She doesn't get a smoke. And then she asks the Croatian guy for a cigarette. He says, no, like, she just wants a smoke, man. Maybe that's why she would have driven away if she got a cigarette, you know?
Oh, yeah. She would have let it go, but you just pushed her a little too hard, and she's not going to give up now. She's going to come back like the jackrabbit and kill your family with a hammer.
Eat your fucking dinner. Let's talk about Ethan Suplee as Gary. He gets a medium-sized role. He's kind of a co-protagonist of the middle act of the movie.
Yes.
Really cool to see him just still out there acting, because I remember him on Boy Meets World. He looks incredibly different. He's lost hundreds of pounds, which, good for him. I remember him also from My Name is Earl. He's a good comedic actor. Been in a lot of culty stuff. He's not like dealing with cults, but if it's got a small budget and you need a guy like this, you get Ethan Suplee. Like, he'll be there. He'll put in a good performance. Macon Blair is another one. I love the actors they chose for these roles. They're just pitch perfect. And just like a lineup of my guys. Like, Macon Blair is one of my guys.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that.
The same way Sturgill Simpson is one of yours. Yeah.
No, that's not fair. I want to pick new guys.
Like, when I saw Blue Ruin for the first time, I bought Macon Blair stock.
Okay.
Like, I was like, all right, I'm investing in this guy. He's going to be a star. And maybe it hasn't worked out to that degree, but he's still awesome. And every time he pops up in something, I'm glad.
I do like him. That's, you know, the Oliver segment, from him rescuing them to her offing him and telling the jackrabbit story, was like my favorite little sequence in the movie. And I'm not sure if it's because it's the best or it's because I saw that sequence a month ago before I watched the movie, when I turned on cable TV late one night. I was in a hotel room over the holidays, and so I didn't have much choice. I'm like, oh, this is that movie, The Hunt. It was late and I only stayed up for 7 minutes, but I happened to watch that sequence, which made me think, oh, I need to watch The Hunt. And then when you're like, we should do The Hunt, I'm like, yeah, I'm on board. So it was like a little extra familiar. I got one more pass at it. But to me, that sums up everything that the movie is good at. that. Being a twisty thriller, great turns, great character actors, great performances, and just compelling stuff.
You got Don in the back. We haven't talked about Don much yet. He's a fun character. We see him in the clearing. So he's been there since the beginning. But when the Croatian cops or whatever they are like, are you being hunted like Don? And she's like, who the fuck is Don? And Don walks out and she's like, yeah, I'm being hunted like Don. And that's after the train sequence. What'd you think of the train sequence with one of our liberal elites pretending to be a refugee?
I was admittedly a little bit confused because it's a lot of moving parts since that's the most complex sequence. We just met Gary. We're not even totally sure that he's cool. And then there's like, oh no, there's refugees. And then all of a sudden the train is stopped and like, what's real? Are the Croatians real? Are we really in Croatia? Is that fake? Are the refugees fake? Oh yeah, the refugees aren't fake, but the one guy is fake. It's a lot to take into your head. And like, it all works. Once you sort it out, it's smart and it moves the plot forward in an interesting way. But that's where I felt weakest on the movie because I was like, I was just a little disoriented for a minute. But it's got good things. Ethan Suplee, like you said, is very funny with all his crisis actor shit. It's over the top, but like you buy it the way he sells it. And then the guy.
It's not that far from some of the stuff we read on Twitter every day.
Stuff you would hear. Yeah, it's not. They didn't have to exaggerate some of the people that are out there. So like it sounds real. And then the other guy lets down his guard. He's speaking Arabic. And then all of a sudden he's like, hey, chill. I really am an actor. I'm really one of the hunters, but let's get out of this situation. I'll give you a little break. And Gary's not going for that.
No, Gary shoves a grenade down his pants, blows his dick right off.
And the rest of him. In a good practical effect. There's real stuff spraying everywhere on that set that day.
Oh yeah, there was some stuff. I'm trying to find the actor's name because I really liked the actor who plays
Crisis Mike.
Crisis Mike. There he is. Usman Ali. He's really great for going from playing this. He's almost annoyed at Gary for being like frazzled and upset.
Yeah.
He's like, Gary, you got to calm the fuck down, man. No, you've been trying to kill him for like hours.
Yeah.
And so I certainly understand Gary's motivation to shove a grenade down his pants. I really liked his performance there. Yeah. We do get a little glimpse of him in the third act when we see the origins of the hunt and he's there. He says that it's racist to make him play a refugee. And they're like, it was your idea, which that's a funny line.
Yeah, it's funny.
All right. That's all I got for this section. Unless we missed something. Did you want to walk us through the ending?
Here we go. Bring us home. Armed with a map, Crystal returns to the bunker in the clearing where the hunt began, and she plans an assault. Most of the hunters are still camped inside the bunker, along with their ex-military consultant, Sergeant Dale, and Crystal cuts them all down one by one, with just a little help from Don. Then Athena's voice comes over the radio, telling Don to kill Crystal. Now, Crystal can't tell if this is a trick or if Don is really on the side of the hunters, so she kills him anyway just to be safe. Then she tortures Athena's location out of the dying Sergeant Dale and strikes out for her final vengeance. Now, in a flashback sequence, we find out how we got here. 1 year ago, Athena's original group chat joke about hunting deplorables was leaked onto the internet. It led to all the executives in the chat resigning in disgrace and ending their careers. So Athena, played by Hilary Swank, got them all together and plotted revenge by engineering an actual hunt on a group of a dozen deplorables, selecting their victims from people who they felt participated meaningfully in spreading the Manorgate conspiracy theory online. Back in the present day, Crystal reaches the Croatian country house that Athena has rented and decked out to be her quote-unquote manor. The two ladies meet and fight hand-to-hand in a knockdown, drag-out brawl that eventually leaves both women stabbed in the gut and badly bleeding. Moments after realizing she kidnapped the wrong Crystal Creasy, Athena dies of her wounds. But infused with the spirit of the jackrabbit, Crystal rallies from the brink of death, cauterizes her wound, eats Athena's lunch, dresses in Athena's gown, takes her rare champagne, and commandeers Athena's private jet to take her back home.
I really liked the back and forth with Sergeant Dale and the rest of the liberal hunters when they're making fun of him because he was a consultant on Tears of the Sun, which I always thought was a really stupid name for a movie. But I think that might be a Stay Tuned as well. I think Tears of the Sun was a bomb. I remember Tears of the Sun coming out very vividly.
He like wins him back over and was like, Bruce Willis was in it. Oh, they were like, oh, okay.
Oh, love Bruce. Yeah, but they're like, why is the sun crying?
It's a funny inside Hollywood type of joke about movie consultants.
Yeah, $100 million budget, $86 million box office. It's a big bomb.
Okay. We shall cry the sun's tears right on this show in the future.
Not next week, but sometime. Eventually. Sometime. Yeah. I just wanted to call that out. So everything in the bunker, I think, is really fun. We get to see the hunters amongst themselves and they're very hateable.
We had some time with the conservative victims and they displayed all their foibles. And then the hunters do the same thing on the liberal side, tone police each other, do all that kind of shit that you would expect them to do. And then they die at the incredible competence of Crystal, who has no problem killing everybody in that room.
Hey, Don helped. helps. He holds a pig.
He holds the pig while she cuts Richard's throat.
The Glenn Howerton character, yeah.
Glenn Howerton character, the kimono-wearing asshole.
It's appropriation.
And then he threw the pig down into the trench to distract them while Crystal moved in to do the actual killing. It's a good, satisfying set of cool kills. It's a fun way to wrap up the majority of the characters of the film before you stage the final one-on-one.
It's also our first glimpse into just how capable of a combatant Crystal is, because she's going against somebody who has some military training in Sergeant Dale.
That's true. He's a very large man. And so she...
he's a huge guy.
Hand to hand. So they don't do that trope, which I'm glad for. Hero at the villain's mercy, or like constantly outmatched and suffering mightily and having to come back. Like, she just kills everybody and it's fun.
She's like the Terminator for the most part.
Yeah.
And the Hilary Swank character, Athena, they do build up her skills by saying she's been training. She seems a little bit fanatical and she's been training for almost a year for this exact purpose. So that kind of explains how she could hold her own against Crystal.
Yeah.
She's clearly like a lifelong martial artist and combatant.
And Crystal gets to do the thing as she does another little quiet speechy moment with the dying Sergeant Dale. And to me, that was actually better, a more impressive acting performance than her Jackrabbit speech, which was very showy. She talks about her bottled up anger and she doesn't say the word anger. She doesn't say any word for it. She just, her eyes tear up and she makes this sound in her throat when she's like, I've got all this little noise. And it's so good. Like, that alone sold me on her as an actor. She's fantastic.
Right in that same sequence, when Dale at first is not going to tell her the location of the farmhouse, she just sticks her finger in his gunshot and he's obviously screaming, but she just keeps going like, sorry.
She's chill. She's like, I gotta do this.
She never like really raises her voice except a handful of times.
And she's funny as you want in an action hero. She can be quippy and light and funny in the presence of extreme danger and pain. But like, when she reveals her anger, it's a moment that you need in an action movie where, oh, now you find out what's really motivating our hero. But you don't usually get a moment that's that good, that feels that real, that human or vulnerable. They're hard to pull off that well. And so I feel like this moved her into an upper tier of action horror heroes in terms of her reality as a person.
Action comedy.
Yeah.
So while we're still in the bunker, let's talk about Don a little bit. The movie tries to play a little fast and loose with our perceptions. And
yes.
Athena gets over the loudspeaker, starts talking to Don as if he was one of the hunters. He maintains until the bitter end that he is not, and she's trying to just turn them against each other. But then, did you notice his accent drops out right when he's like saying his final line?
I didn't notice that. You mentioned it and I had to go back and replay it. I'm like, damn, you're right. Did the actor mess that up, or is that a really subtle? Because he's shouting. It's a little subtle, but it's well played to keep you guessing. You never know, and Athena never admits, right?
Yeah, we never see him in the planning of the hunt. There's never mention of a mysterious guy that we don't like. I think we meet all the characters that are referenced in the group chat and in the meeting with the executives. So there's not like anyone unaccounted for as far as I can remember.
You mean, amongst the rich elite group chatters, but he also doesn't show up in the planning of the victims because they've got slideshow of the people they're picking and he doesn't show up there either.
They don't get through them all either though.
No, but there's one scene where at the end where Crystal comes into the house and there's 8x10s on the wall of all the victims, but like,
he's not there.
You can't see because there's two in the bottom row and the camera doesn't tilt down to show the bottom row when she gets close enough where you could have
those
seen.
Fuckers.
It's very carefully crafted. It's very
damn
sharp.
You, Zobel and Lindelof, you love to keep me guessing.
Yep.
I just rewatched Mare of Easttown. Fucking Zobel.
Yeah.
The bitter end. I'm going with Don is actually a plant. I think he's an imposter, but it's a kind of a clever little frustrating play on the idea. But now Don had to go because we had to get the one-on-one.
Yeah. Yep.
That's really what the movie was building towards.
Yeah.
And I like that Athena's not cowering in fear when Crystal tells her she's coming to get her. She's like, yeah, let's do this.
So even if Don was on her side, he was expendable the whole time because what she really wanted was a showdown with Crystal. She would have been disappointed if Don had just shot Crystal and that was over.
Yeah, that would have been a bummer. I would have been furious if Don ended up being the secret protagonist. They did it again.
At the end of the movie. Actually, it's me, Don.
Don, who is played by Robert Duvall's second cousin.
Oh, I saw that. That's crazy.
His name is something Duvall. It's Wayne Duvall.
Wayne's good. He doesn't have the track record of Robert, but he's good as a character actor.
He's got more credits than Robert, I think, but maybe not of the same caliber. He's definitely that guy. He's been in so much stuff. His IMDb, I was trying to find the highlights from it, and I was like, no, there's just too many things. And they're all like man with hat or like Phil. You know, no last name. He's that kind of guy.
Speaking of guys with interesting credits, there's one guy with a small role who's been in a bunch of Scorsese movies, including The Aviator, The Departed, Wolf of Wall Street, Irishman, Killers of the Flower Moon. Do you know who that might be?
Are you talking about Mr. J.C. McKenzie?
I am.
He's good. Yeah, he plays a corporate indifference. sequence very well, I guess, so is the best way I could put it.
Yeah, so now we're talking about the origin story flashback when, just before the final showdown, we learn how this whole thing unfolded, and it starts with Athena getting talked to by, you know, whoever this Paul guy is, and Nicole, some of her vice presidents of her company that she's CEO of.
Yeah, he's got to be like chairman of the board or something, like, to outrank the CEO.
That's a good point. But yeah, he plays that pitch perfect. It's such a good corporate world switch, and we haven't seen that much of it. The rest of the stuff between the corporate types was all cheesy chit-chat, and he makes this corporate scene really real, where you're like, no, I can believe it. These people had to all resign, and it's kind of a big stretch. The premise of the movie, they're resigning based on this group chat leaking, but he sells it, and it's a compelling scene.
Also, that office is nuts.
I heard, and I'm not sure if this is true, that that is Jason Blum's actual office.
What?
I don't know if it's correct. That's
that
unsourced.
Breaking it in. That's a huge fucking office. It's huge, it's like 30 feet high.
It's a beautiful glass paneled office somewhere in the middle of Century City or something.
Sheesh. Good for Jason Blum. That's why he keeps the budgets low. He's
like, pay for the, all the money.
You know how expensive it is to heat this office with all its glass and high ceilings? It's got to be thousands of dollars a month. So the origin story is pretty cool. I like the play that the hunt wasn't real until the conspiracy theorists willed it into existence.
Yeah.
That feels like the first time where we get a feeling that, like, the conservative characters, not that they had it coming, but like they had some hand in this whole situation.
And the two of them argue about whether that makes any sense, which it kind of doesn't. Like, it makes the premise feel plausible enough that you could see a bunch of rich, powerful, privileged people losing their jobs because of an optics controversy, as Paul puts it, and being really mad. Now, only in the movies do they become a homicidal pack of human hunters, but like the feelings behind it and the mechanics behind it feel pretty real.
Yeah, there's nothing Athena does in this movie, including flying to Croatia to kill a bunch of people, that I couldn't imagine like John McAfee doing. It's not that far-fetched. There's some crazy fucking people out there. But the whole plotting scene. So the movie has played coy up to this point with who we're dealing with.
That's
who
right.
Is Athena. Now, I did want to say, I clocked it.
Oh.
First time I watched it, I was like, it's fucking Hilary Swank.
Because
a movie I love deeply, Logan Lucky, does a similar thing where at the final scene, she's talking to Adam Driver's character and you only see the back of her head. And then it's like a big reveal that she's the one. So I learned to zero in on that voice. And she's got a very distinctive voice.
That's funny. That movie was like practice for identifying Hillary from the back when they don't want to show her on screen. It added some fun to the movie for me. I did not clock her. And I suppose if I would have read about the movie in advance, I would have seen that she was in the cast and put it together. But I fortunately didn't know anything about the movie going in. And it's not a reveal where you're like, oh my God, Hillary Swank, that changes everything. It changes nothing. But it somehow imparts her character with extra gravity that you didn't even get to see her face until now. And now we have to confront her. And she's a strong actor and a strong presence. And for me, if Betty Gilpin hadn't already taken the film by the balls, it would have been like, oh, wow, exciting. Somebody with a lot of weightiness has entered the room. Now it's like, oh, thank goodness that they have somebody with the kind of gravitas of Hilary Swank, because we need someone powerful to stand up against Betty Gilpin's Crystal.
Right. With a lesser actress or even just a less, like, Hilary Swank's physically fit. You just need somebody who's believable. You could tell she doesn't just do like cardio.
Yeah, they both have just the right physicality for it. It's really good. They must have been so stoked when they cast both of them in those roles. They're like, yes, we got it perfect. Got exactly who we needed.
And then there's the big fight scene while we're talking about it. It's a long one, but it's entertaining. There's little moments in it that I just adore. Like when Betty tries to swing from that second floor landing.
Yes.
She starts to swing from a rope and it just immediately snaps. And she absolutely eats shit landing on like her back on like the corner of a coffee table.
Yeah, some kind of decorative rope thing that's not for pulling on. There's a lot of that. It's a long drawn out fight, which sometimes I go, oh no, I've got to get through a long drawn out fight. But I felt it was grounded. You felt like they were getting hurt, not in an over the top way, but in a kind of realistic way. I don't know. I appreciated that it worked. And there were plenty of funny and fun and creative and clever moments that kept me going. It's like over 5 minutes of just the two ladies punching each other around a house.
I did love when Crystal has Athena by the hair and is about to throw her through the back door. And she goes, no more glass.
She opens the door because they both went out the glass picture window on the way out into the garden. And then on the way in, she's like, no more glass. Very funny.
And the way Crystal gets Athena is she gets stabbed with something, but then she just thrusts her belly where the knife still is into Athena too.
It's one of those food processor blades. It's got a curvy blade.
Those things are sharp as dick, man. I've cut my hand on them before, like just taking them out of the drying rack after I wash them.
Yeah, those are scary.
If you're not careful, those will fuck you up. So yeah, she's got the food processor blade in her stomach and Athena's gloating a little bit. Maybe she thinks she's won. And then Crystal just hugs her.
Hugs her, transfers the blade over to Athena.
And Athena can't survive it, but Crystal can.
And there's a funny moment. There was some question whether in the midst of this fight, Crystal goes, you got the wrong Crystal, May Kreese. Tracy, there's another one, lives in my town. I get her mail sometimes. And it's another
I didn't want to spoil your grilled cheese speech.
Right. Yeah, because they have this long verbal standoff and she's telling her all about herself and she's like, that's not me. And then Athena doesn't believe her. And I think, unlike Don, who they intentionally left very ambiguous, I did come away with the idea in the end that this is the wrong crystal.
Yes, agreed.
Because in this case, Athena admits it. She asks her with her dying breath, tell me one last thing. Are you really whatever the screen name was? And she's like, no, ma'am, I'm not. And she goes, whoops, and she dies. So it's like she accepted that she got the wrong girl.
Yeah. I didn't even really consider it as a possibility until you brought it up briefly in one of our early discussions about the movie. You said a line like, if you buy into the fact that it's the wrong crystal. So I was like, huh, that wasn't even an angle I'd considered up to this point.
Well, Athena does doubt her and says bullshit, but there's no actual reasons. And Crystal is plenty confident defending herself that she's not the one that they thought she was.
Yeah. And you'd put a note in here asking if you can pull any meaning out of the realization that the head conservative wasn't as narrow-minded as we thought. But I'm not really sure Crystal even is a conservative. We don't really get any insight into her political beliefs because what we know about her is that she has traits that I think people might associate more with conservatives than with more left-leaning people. Like she has experience hunting. She's been around firearms. She served in the military, but she never says anything about politics explicitly. And whatever her views are, it seems like she keeps them to herself, which I think is maybe what the movie is trying to say. Wasn't everyone just calm the fuck down yelling at each other on the internet and keep politics to yourself, which isn't a stance I can fully endorse because like politics affects everybody and you need to take a stand at sometimes.
But maybe that's what the movie is saying. Keep it to yourself until they fuck with you and then kill everyone on both sides. I don't know.
Very fine people.
I don't know that Damon Lindelof wanted us to fully deconstruct and go symbolically, the apolitical person kills the liberals and she kills one of the, like, and try to do the math and figure out who's the winner and what it really means. To me, I see the movie as more of a scream of frustration and go, man, all this shit is so fucked up. It's almost like a horror movie. The threat of physical violence is in the air. People are at each other's throats. And it makes me think of a violent action movie. So let's just show it as that, because making that movie is some kind of catharsis in itself for dealing with the world in the state it's in today.
I like that reading. That's a good way to look at it. And feels truer to who I know. Not that I know Damon Lindelof personally, but what I know of, like, he's never been afraid to pick a side. Watchmen got a lot of flack from more conservative media
or
featuring minority characters and female characters and gender swapping and race swapping. There was a lot of backlash to that, and he did not shrink in the light of that criticism. He stood behind the product. So I don't think he's afraid to take a stand politically, but I certainly can empathize with him just feeling overwhelmed and frustrated by the current climate of America and just wanting to let it out somehow.
Yeah, so that would be my advice to people who want to come into this movie and might feel like, oh, am I going to get irritated by the politics? If you watch it as a action movie, a violent thriller, horror-esque movie, that's just going to give you some kind of release about your feelings on it and don't try to do the math on the politics, you're much more likely to enjoy it, which I really did. I thought this was a banger of a movie.
Certified banger. I've never recommended it to anybody who didn't come back and say, yo, that was a banger.
Oh, okay.
Everyone I tell about this movie likes it. It's a movie I can easily see myself rewatching like once a year, just like a new friend comes over and I'm like, you never seen The Hunt? Let's get some beers and watch The Hunt. You know, it's just, it's that kind of movie.
It's really watchable too, because it moves so fast and seamlessly that you could be in the third act before you even realize it, because it doesn't let up.
Expertly paced. It's 90 minutes long. It feels shorter somehow.
Yeah.
You're never looking at the clock in this movie.
No, really fun.
All right. So that was The Hunt. Let's talk a little bit about some of the people involved and what they've been up to. We have a little more time to work with now than we did with the last few movies. A
couple of years have passed.
You want to know something crazy about Craig Zobel?
Tell me.
He's the co-creator of fucking Homestar Runner. You remember Homestar Runner?
I do. I wasn't like immersed in that, but I picked up on it a little bit.
Yeah, Strong Bad. It's Craig Zobel and a handful of his friends came up with that concept. Pretty cool. He also directed Great World of Sound, Compliance, and Z for Zachariah. I've seen Compliance. It's one of those movies that makes you want to wash your brain.
Okay.
Super fucked up, based on a true story.
I've heard about the true story, and it does sound really fucked up.
Yeah, the prank caller that was basically like calling fast food places and forcing like young employees to basically humiliate themselves under the guise that he was a cop.
Super weird, man.
Super weird, and like he got away with it so many times. But then it's well made. It's a movie I'll never watch again. But it's got Ann Dowd, Bill Camp, good cast, but super upsetting. Like I said, so he's directed some of the best episodes of The Leftovers and one of the best Westworld episodes. He directed all 10 episodes of a show called $1, which we talked about briefly at the top of the show. Also directed all of Mayor of Easttown, which if you know me and Ian, we love some Mayor.
Legendary show.
And he's also directed at least the first 3 episodes of The Penguin. Oh, I don't know if he's God. How much of that he's directing, but yeah, we're hyped for that one. That'll be good.
I'm hyped for that.
I love it. Like, Colin Farrell's performance in The Batman is one of my just all-time favorite campy, like, over there. What are you showing me here? He's fucking great.
He's a fun actor.
He's one of the handsomest men ever born, and they were like, let's just put him in 40 pounds of bullshit and make him look stupid, but it works. We're going to make this handsome, strapping Irishman play, like, a New York mobster who's squat and rotund.
And he loves it so much. Like, he's so excited.
He's having the time of his life. Absolutely having the time of his life. All right, so let's talk about Nick Hughes and Damon Lindelof. We talked about Lindelof quite a bit throughout the episode. Nick Hughes, not so much, but he seems to be under Lindelof's wing, which is appropriate because Lindelof came up under the wing of Carlton Hughes, who is Nick Hughes' father.
That is really cool. I just learned about that while learning about this movie. It's a cool bit of family history there.
Carlton Hughes and Damon Lindelof were like co-showrunners on Lost for the majority of its run, worked on some other stuff together as well. But so Nick Hughes, as far as I know, he's only a writer. He hasn't done any kind of producing, directing, or show running yet, but that's not to say it can't happen. He's written episodes of Station 11, a show we both loved.
Yeah, great.
Watchmen, a show we both loved. Maniac and The Leftovers, a show we both loved. I never saw Maniac.
Yeah, me neither, but pretty good track record.
Yeah. Lindelof, my motherfucking man, showrunner of Lost, helped write Cowboys and Aliens, so they can't all be hits. Co-wrote Prometheus, wrote Star Trek Into Darkness, wrote World War Z, wrote Tomorrowland, so we'll be featuring another Damon Lindelof project in the nearish future.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
That was a big-time bomb, but a movie I'm fond of.
Okay.
He co-created The Leftovers, and then he created Mrs. Davis, so he's a legend in the TV world, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So Gilpin, yeah, hasn't had much luck in movies up to this point. She's been in stuff like Stuber, which is okay. I don't hate Stuber, but it's not cinema. You remember Stuber, right? The Kumail Nanjiani and Dave Bautista. He's an Uber driver and Dave Bautista's a cop. He needs to get around the city.
Oh my gosh. I had totally forgotten. That was like, yeah, weird gimmick movie. And I think I saw part of it. That's so crazy. It had totally vacated my mind. But now I remember that.
It's not terrible. She was in the reboot of the remake of The Grudge, which sucks a fat dick. She was in a movie called Coffee and Kareem.
Okay.
She had a nothing role in the Tomorrow War playing Chris Pratt's wife.
Oh, okay.
She deserves better, both in men and roles. But she's had much better luck on TV. She starred in Nurse Jackie, Masters of Sex, Glow, Gaslit, Mrs. Davis, a voice role in Skull Island, and the lead role in Three Women. And she will star in upcoming miniseries American Primeval alongside who, Ian?
Says right here, our boy, Taylor Kitsch.
The patron saint of Blast Zone. The first, the last, the only. Taylor Kitsch.
Founding father.
John Carter of Mars himself. Yeah, I'm obviously going to watch that. Betty Gilpin and Taylor Kitsch.
Yeah.
Like, come on. It's like they made it for me. I hope it's good.
I hope so too.
I'd be so mad if it's bad. Like, you get those people together and it sucks. That would be miserable.
Oh, wait. You know who else is in that? Shea Whigham.
What the fuck? Of course he's out of control.
Of course he is. Yeah, it's going to be great.
He could have been one of the conservatives in this movie.
Yeah.
He could have been like Don. He could have been the Don character.
Shea Whigham could have been on either side and totally convinced us he was that person. That's how good he is.
It's true, because he plays like, he's always playing. I think you brought it up when we were talking about him a few weeks ago. He can either play like a real, like, down on his luck alcoholic uncle, or he can play like a spook for the CIA. You know, you can buy him in any of those roles. He has incredible range. Love Shea Whigham. Oof, my loins are burning for this show.
Didn't mean to stir you up there.
Ooh, what am I supposed to read? I can't even remember. Hilary Swank, she hasn't been in a ton of high profile movies lately. She obviously had a very storied movie career.
Sure.
Earlier with stuff like Boys Don't Cry and Million Dollar Baby. She's won Oscars. But lately she's been in stuff like Tal, The Good Mother, and Ordinary Angels. Never heard of any of that. So whatevs. But she's also starred in stuff on TV like Trust, Away, Alaska Daily, also stuff I've never heard of.
That's too bad. She's really a fine actress, still obviously capable of all kinds of stuff. This was like a juicy role. It's a shame. This dang movie with a $14 million budget should have probably taken in $65 million and made a bunch of people happy at the studio, but bad timing.
Yeah, and she's very great at coming into a movie in the third act. She does it in Logan Lucky too, and changes the game. So if you liked her performance in this movie, if you decide to watch it based on the show, I'd also recommend checking out Logan Lucky. Similar character, very intense, very focused, but less insane.
A stabby.
Those are the only two people I really wanted to discuss. Okay. So that's that. Should we let the folks know what we're covering next week?
Yeah, maybe let me know. Do I know?
I told you, but it was a couple weeks ago. You might have forgotten.
I forgot.
And after this, we got to go back to the 80s or 90s because we're doing too much stuff in the recent past. But I feel like we've waited long enough. We can't avoid it anymore. It's time to do Dear Evan Hansen.
You did tell me.
And you just tried to black it out.
You just went right through my brain and out the other side. Going to be really interesting. I've heard little things about it. Know people who are into musical theater, and I'm not really one of them, but I'm going to find out if I can be.
We've already established I am the mayor of Footloose, but for singing. So you know where I stand on this. Ben Platt does have a good singing voice, so at least there's that. I remember him from Pitch Perfect. He's a fine singer, so at least hopefully the songs will be good.
Let's hope for the best. Going in not knowing what to expect. Open-minded, hopefully.
All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. All the things. Rate, review, subscribe.
Any of those things, please.
All those words. Follow us on Twitter at BlastZonePod. Email us, BlastZonePod@gmail.com. That's good for any movie recommendations, podcast feedback, suggestions. You just want to chat about movies. We appreciate getting emails and DMs, so don't hesitate.
We'd love to hear from you.
And we'll see you next time in the Blast Zone.
See you next time in the Blast Zone. The Blast Zone.